Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about whistleblowing, and I expect that people know what that term means. What we're talking about here is when an individual, this could be someone who works for the government, could be someone who works for private industry, believes that their employer is somehow responsible for fraud, waste, abuse, misconduct, wrongdoing, and this is definitely something that's not in the public interest. In some cases, what these people do is they go to their immediate superiors or supervisors to try to bring the problem to their attention. However, it is also the case, and sometimes these cases get a great deal of attention, that these people feel that the only way to get the problem dealt with and corrected is actually to go outside of their organization and to take their concerns public. And these cases can indeed get a great deal of attention in the national media, and that doesn't always go well with the individual that is blowing the whistle. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with one of the nation's foremost experts in whistleblower protection law. His name is Stephen Cohn, and he is the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington, D.C. They do indeed have a website. If you're interested, you can go to that place and find out more about the center and about the issue. And we'll also be talking here this morning about some basic things about whistleblowing, who the people are who do this, why they do it, and what the experience is like for them. Questions are certainly welcome here during this hour of Focus 580. The number, if you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the local number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you are listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And we do also, again, have that local number for Champaign-Urbana folks, 333-9455. At any point here, questions welcome. We'll just ask people to try to be brief so that we can keep moving along, but we certainly welcome calls. Mr. Cohn, hello.
Good. Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks. And yourself?
Great.
Well, we appreciate you talking with us today. And I think that perhaps some of, at least, our interest was piqued in some stories that we came across. And actually, I think that some of these stories are not exactly new. They go back maybe a couple of years. But stories that note that, let us say, over the last about 7 years, and maybe the benchmark date is September 11th. Over that period of time, the number of employees, and I guess here now we're talking about federal government employees, filing whistleblower disclosures with the government had risen significantly. And this, I believe here now, I'm looking at numbers that come from the Office of the Special Counsel. Can you talk a little bit about that, just simply the incidence of whistleblowing? Is it indeed, has it over the last few years significantly gone up?
Yes. I think the 9/11 attack was a turning point, because what we've all learned since then is that there were employees and whistleblowers who had very specific knowledge about some of those terrorists and some of the plans. Some of them had come forward and complained and had been retaliated against. A lot of them had information but really didn't push it as hard as they, I think, would have, knowing what happened. After 9/11, there was a heightened awareness that if you have information that might be negative to the public interest, you really should step forward and report it. And so there was a major turning point. The second major turning point was the Wall Street collapse in 2002 of Enron and WorldCom. And as the listeners may remember, these were multi-billion dollar financial enterprises, some of whom had been rated very high and billions in investments, people's life savings tied up in these companies, and they just collapsed. And people lost billions And again, there were employees within those companies who had inside knowledge. Some had come forward and reported it, but it became very clear that it was in the public interest to be a little more aggressive and bring this stuff forward. And those were the turning points. And then Time magazine put three whistleblowers on the cover as People of the Year in the end of 2002. And I think the public acceptance of whistleblowers changed. And I think employees began to understand that there was an obligation and a duty not just to sit on this type of information, but to step forward as necessary.
Do you think that it was the case that prior to that, that the public perception was that whistleblowers were disgruntled employees, they were people who had grudges against their employers, and that they were motivated by some desire to get even rather than the desire to do some public service?
You know, it's an excellent question. I've been representing whistleblowers since 1984. I've written a couple books on it. And back in the day when it hadn't been as popular, I literally read almost every decision and got a real feel for what was going on in the area. It's an issue-by-issue circumstance. It's funny. If you agreed with what the whistleblower was doing, the whistleblower was a hero, was someone to be encouraged and praised. If the whistleblower you disagreed with, they were a disgruntled employee and the skunk at the picnic. And we saw this time and time again in local politics and why the whistleblowers were coming to Washington, D.C. looking for lawyers and looking for help. Because in a local area, there might be a factory or an industry that has a lot of dominance. And if you blow the whistle on that company, you're a Rat Fink. People may feel their jobs are threatened. And within the local community, it will be frowned upon. So a lot of the whistleblowers were smart enough, I think, to say, okay, I think I need to go out of state, get someone in here who's not conflicted. But we saw it just over and over again, like in the atomic energy industry. You blew the whistle, you were blacklisted. But outside of that industry, with environmentalists and people like that, you might be considered a hero and fully supported. So it's kind of like a tag. Now, I will tell you that most almost all the whistleblowers I've represented would not be put into the classification as a disgruntled employee. And although obviously there will be some, and some motives will be mixed and some might be questionable, but in reality, if you think about what an employee puts at risk when they blow the whistle, it's very, very rare that someone will become a whistleblower as a way, say, just to retaliate because they're unhappy at work. Why? Blacklisting. If you get the reputation of being a whistleblower, how do you think that's going to impact your getting another job? Who wants to hire a whistleblower? So if an employee, say, is disgruntled and has some problems on the job, why would they choose to do something that may not only hurt them where they're currently employed, but could pretty much sabotage their ability to get a good job ever again in their profession? So the accusation and the allegation, yes, always happens. Why? And again, that's kind of common sense. If you're a company and you've done something wrong, and you know, and the examples are all over the map, like we've had cases where they just illegally stored hazardous waste. Now, they were just cutting corners. Were they evil? No, but they illegally stored it. Put the public at risk, an employee goes, turns it in. The company could have shook the employee's hand and said, great job, but instead, unfortunately, they go to a cover-up and they say, oh, no, we didn't do anything wrong. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He's a disgruntled employee. You know, 3 years later, you find out the truth, but that's a typical management response to a whistleblower unless they admit to the wrongdoing, which is rare. You know, people don't like to have their faults pointed out. It's just human nature.
Let me introduce again our guest for anyone who might just have tuned in. Our guest is Stephen Cohen. He is the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington, D.C. He is one of the nation's leading experts in whistleblower protection law. They do have a website, and I want to mention the URL in case you're interested in finding out more about the issue in the organization. It's pretty easy, www.whistleblowers, that's all as one word, whistleblowers.org. And here, what questions are welcome. In fact, we have somebody who is ready to go, so we will talk with them. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have that toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Elburn, and that's on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, you know what? I can't say enough for your organization, sir. I had a confrontation like this come up years ago. That's why I'm not in my last job. Same thing happened to me. Problem is, I got sense and I said, this job is not worth it, and got out. And it was almost like a force you out type of thing. I blew the whistle on somebody, and from that day on, it was nothing but hell in that position. And it was serious enough, but my boss thought I was pulling his leg. The only thing I could tell you is that if you're going to blow the whistle, and this is just from my experience, if anybody's going to blow the whistle on anybody, it has to be in numbers and not single. In other words, one person can't do it. You have to have somebody to back you up. If you don't have anybody to back you up, then it's not worth it. Go find another job. That's what I usually say. I think it's unfortunate, but that's the way society is anymore. It's not what you know, it's who you know. And I think it has a lot to come down to that who you know bit. Unless you're really good in with somebody that can help you in whatever particular position or company you're with, then I can tell you my experience is not worth, it's not worth working in that place, because I spent 4 years of hell with this. And it didn't change anything. And they found out afterwards, about 3 or 4 years after I'd quit, what the story was that I told them. They realized they did screw up, but it was a day late and a dollar short.
Well, Mr. Cohen, you can comment on that at all, or any way that you
like? Yeah, I think, and thank you for the compliment for the Whistleblower Center. What the caller has said is extremely accurate, but I would need to essentially just comment on it somewhat. If you blow the whistle and you have no support, which means there's no other employee going to back you up, those are tough cases to win. And believe me, you don't want to lose the whistleblower case. That can really impact your career. Because the company who controls the witnesses and controls the documents, and they'll have no problem getting people to attack your work or say there was no problem and essentially paint you as a disgruntled employee or employee with performance issues, even if you didn't have any. It's not hard to get someone up there on the stand and say, oh, they were hard, difficult to work with. They came in late. They argued with a customer 2 years ago. On the other hand, if you have a coworker or even sometimes your supervisor who's willing to back you up, it can make all the difference. Some of our strongest cases are when a person's supervisor actually supports the whistleblower, their frontline supervisor, and it almost checkmates the ability of the company to fire that whistleblower because they have to go through the supervisor. And we've actually represented supervisors who were removed from their jobs for supporting the whistleblower. So, that's a big thing. Now, if you don't have anyone to back you up and you're all alone, does that mean you should not blow the whistle? This is where I want to put a caveat. If you really need to get legal counsel, and it's a judgment call how much risk you want to take in blowing the whistle, and it's a judgment call based on the following factors. One, how serious is the issue? Is it life-threatening? You know, it's kind of just on a plane. Or is it something that, you know, okay, it's wrong, they're violating the law, but it's just not worth losing my job over, versus life is at risk. And again, it's a person's call. The second issue is what law protects you. If the laws out there, and they're all over the map, are weak, like, for example, one of the worst areas is health care. Nurses and doctors are constantly coming to the whistleblower center complaining about retaliation. There's no federal law. The state laws are, some of them are okay, some are terrible. But patient care is a big, big issue right now in whistleblowing. There's no federal protections that are worth anything. So some of these healthcare professionals are concerned about the lives and safety of their patients, and they have to weigh what their protections are if they go forward. There's one whistleblower law, which is the exception to all whistleblower laws, and it's the one that I really, since it's the best one in the country, it's one I really always make a question any prospective client or any person who's blowing the whistle as to whether this law covers you. Because all the rules change under the law known as the False Claims Act. This is, in a sense, America's first whistleblower law. It was signed by President Abe Lincoln in 1863 during the Civil War, when America experienced for the first time systemic ripoff of taxpayer money. You know, there were lots of contracts during the Civil War for war goods, bullets, horses, wagons, muskets, uniforms, and there was a lot of fraud in selling these goods to the government. Very much like you see in the War of Iraq right now, where there's dirty water, overbilling, charging for items that were never built or constructed or that didn't work. That happened in the Civil War, and the Civil War Congress passed a really good law, the False Claims Act. This law was so good that it was effectively repealed during World War II, when special interests, again, who were profiting from sale of products during World War II, didn't want to be liable. And then in 1986, it was amended and re-strengthened, and now it's a good law. And if you file under it, it can be effective, because this is what the law does. It's the only whistleblower law that rewards the whistleblower. All other whistleblower laws, you're essentially fighting to get your job back. It's like an employment discrimination law. Basic relief, reinstatement, back pay, compensatory, sometimes punitive damages. But it's all about getting your job back. The False Claims Act permits the whistleblower to share in the proceeds of their whistleblowing. So in other words, if a company has $1 million contract ripoff against the taxpayer, under the False Claims Act, that ripoff is tripled in size, so the company would owe the government $3 million, and then the whistleblower gets between 15 and 30% of that $3 million automatically. So you could be seeing, you know, in a case where there was, a $100 million ripoff, this whistleblower getting a substantial reward. And every year right now, the federal government is collecting $2 billion from whistleblowers, and the whistleblowers are sharing in that. So the rewards can be substantial. The False Claims Act also has an employment discrimination law, which is similar to all other whistleblower, you know, general employment laws. So you can protect your job, but you can share in the proceeds. And depending on your evidence, you may want to go forward with a False Claims Act, believe me, if you're the only one who's doing it, because the rewards can be substantial. In fact, if you look at the records, there are whistleblowers who've actually been able to collect $10, $15, $20, $30, $40 million in rewards. And that's exactly what Abe Lincoln and the Civil War Congress wanted to see happen.
And this, in this case, and if I understand this right, what you're literally doing as the whistleblower is you're suing on behalf of the government. It's in a case where perhaps really the government ought to be the plaintiff, then the whistleblower becomes the plaintiff, and then the government can come along and weigh in on it. But that's how it is that you that then the argument is made that then also the person who was the whistleblower should get to have some of the damages that are awarded.
Yeah, exactly. Now, and it's so interesting. The doctrine behind the False Claims Act is very old. It's called qui tam. It's an old Latin term. But its origins were at a time when governments were very small. If you go back, say, to the Civil War, I mean, the Justice Department was tiny. There was no FBI. There was no Inspector General. Who was out there policing anything? So the government turns to the people and says, American people, defend the integrity of our country. And if you do, we will reward you for it. And it works. And that's what is so incredible about this law, because it's really the government turning to the individual American worker and saying, you know, workers of America, you know, employees, help the government. You know, if someone is building a tank and the tank may not work, help us. We're working on a case right now of bulletproof vests where companies were selling bulletproof vests that were defective, and a policeman actually died in one case in which the bullet went through the vest. Now, your listeners may say this is unbelievably outrageous. How can people be selling vests that don't work to policemen? Well, it's called greed. It's called cost-benefit analysis. It's called, I want to make my money. It happens a lot. Luckily, you get a worker who knows what's going on, steps forward, and that's what we want. Now, whistleblowers do that all over the place. They can do it for protecting the environment. They can do it for protecting patients. They can do it for exposing, say, faults in the war on terror or corporate fraud against shareholders. The only law that really encourages it and rewards it is when the whistleblower stands up and does it on government contracting. Other laws really should get fixed. They should get amended. They should be strengthened. But I'm saying is because Congress did do this one law for government contracting, that's the one to look at and hope that a whistleblower can set a claim under that law. That doesn't mean you shouldn't blow the whistle on other areas. There are laws. They can be effective. You can get your job back, but they can often be tough cases, and you put a lot at risk.
I would think that this particular kind of bringing this kind of action, though, the risk would be that if one wanted to impugn the motives of the person bringing the action, the possibility of an enormous cash award would be a good way to do it.
Well, you know, that's very true, but this is the fascinating part about the False Claims Act, and one of the reasons it's so good for the whistleblower. It's the only whistleblower law that allows the whistleblower to test the merits of what they're blowing the whistle on. Like, for example, if you're, say, in the environment and you're alleging they're illegally dumping hazardous waste in the river, you, the whistleblower, don't prove that they illegally dumped the waste. You're kind of dependent upon, say, the Environmental Protection Agency coming in, doing an investigation, and proving you correct. Your standing as a whistleblower is to protect your job. That's what's at issue, is your job and whether they should have fired you. Under the False Claims Act, you, the whistleblower, can independently prove that the company did act in a fraudulent manner. That's where the law becomes so effective, because the employee can go in there and prove their case. Not that, forget whether they were fired or not, they can prove that fraud occurred. And with and that's why the law has been so successful. But if that becomes the issue, all of a sudden, it's not whether you were late, whether you were a good or bad worker, whether you were drunk on the job. That's not the issue. The issue is, did they lie to get the contract? Did they cheat on the quality of the goods sold? And if you can show that, you win your case. So it changes the entire nature of the whistleblower proceeding. And it, and what's incredible about it, in the one law that you can really test the credibility of the whistleblower, it becomes the most successful whistleblower law. And essentially, you quantify by the billions of dollars how successful whistleblowing is. So it's you know, so in some ways, it's the greatest thing for whistleblowing, because it's no longer an issue of, did the whistleblower help the American people? Was the whistleblower right or wrong? We'll never know. No, we know the whistleblower was correct. We know the taxpayers have saved billions and billions. We know that these corrupt contractors have been put out of business. You know, we did a case. Well, you know, they didn't collect very much money, but all of the corrupt contractors went to prison. And that's not uncommon. And the whistleblowers did that. So, you know, that's a good law, and it changes the nature of the case.
We're at our midpoint here, and I have a caller I get right to, but again, I'd like to introduce again the guest for anyone who might just have tuned in. We're talking with Stephen Cohn. He is the executive director of the National Whistleblower Center in Washington, D.C. He is one of the nation's leading experts on whistleblower protection law, has authored or co-authored a number of books on the subject, whistleblower law. He successfully represented whistleblowers in a number of cases, and he's also testified in Congress on behalf of whistleblower reforms. If you're interested in finding out more about his organization or the issue, go to their website. It's www.whistleblowers.org. And we have a caller here to bring in to the conversation here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Extremely important. Thanks for the program. Thanks for your efforts. Do you know specifically a case of Donald Vance? He's a Navy veteran. I believe he's returned to Chicago. He was in Iraq working for private contractors. Are you familiar with that case?
I'm almost certain I've heard the name. I do not.
Okay, well, let me. It's a fascinating one, because it sort of brings it up to contemporary times, when we have the additional complication of these military contractors sort of cutouts that makes it even murkier about how the liability is shared. He was in Iraq working for private contractors, both Iraqi and American. He was working for an American, or an, I guess it was transnational one. And he started keeping information about the sales of heavy weapons to curious groups, militias, different types, through the agency, the contractor he was working for. He turned it over to the FBI in the U.S. and was in a heap of trouble. He was extracted by American military from the by special forces from the contractor, but then he was turned over to and incarcerated, and he was kept for 3 months in similar. This is documented from testimony before the Democratic Policy Committee (DPC). Donald Vance. You can find audio and video files of his testimony, along with other people that testified, including one of the mothers of the Blackwater people that were killed. So it's an astonishing tale. My surmise is that it doesn't have legs, is because it's just too sensitive. I think they were shipping weapons to like PJAC on the Iran-Iraqi border, part of the covert actions that's going on. But that's neither here nor there. But it's a fascinating story, and is well worth your attention. I wish I'm bringing it up mainly to air it. He's, as I say, he's got a court case, but there's very little publicity about it, and he definitely needs support. And it highlights the fact that, or the idea that, in this new arrangement, as it were, of who is actually the you know, who do you go to when you're working for a private contractor and they're infracting? I mean, where do you blow the whistle? He's completely courageous and is suffering consequent to his, you know, they did the same kind of psychological torture and isolation and loud sounds that they were doing, you know, down the way. So I don't know if you have any comments on this contemporary situation as a... Thanks a lot. I'll listen.
I do, and thank you for reminding me that. As it turns out, I actually testified also at that same hearing. I knew it rang a bell. I just can't remember all these things, but I was there, and I now know the case absolutely. What you're saying correctly summarizes what happened, and the case is really points to it, it's a real mirror into whistleblowing and some of the worst side of it. First off, there are deficiencies in the laws, and his case and the fact that he has just not slam-dunked won that case right now, you know, it's like pretty shocking given what happened to him. But the second part is most Americans will not really have no experience with how much retaliation a whistleblower can experience. And it's hard. It's just hard. Unless you've been there, it's hard to understand that in a very open and democratic society where you hear all this political debate going on and it's easy to really feel very free and open. But when you're in an industry, when you're in a company, when your livelihood depends on your work, when you're easily blacklisted, and believe me, that's very easy. Everyone wants to know who your former employer was. Everyone wants to know why you left your former job. That things can turn on you in ways that are really, really, really tough. That's why I always say, and I really encourage people to seek legal representation even before they blow the whistle to prevent some of these hardships and to strengthen it. In his particular case, he did what almost every whistleblower does. He reported these concerns to his management. He went to the appropriate governmental entity. And unfortunately, that often doesn't work. And he was in Iraq. He turned in information that they absolutely wanted to keep covered up. He was extremely vulnerable because he was in a foreign nation that's under military control. And he was abused in ways that are extraordinary, in a sense that he was detained and perhaps tortured, clearly abused while being detained. But he's in a war zone, you know, and I can't second guess anything that happened in that case, but I would hope that to get the whistleblower out of the war zone before they actually become public or well known. But his case is a real window into how extraordinary these issues can be. And that's the one thing, in a sense, that always dumbfounds me, is the level of anger and retaliation. It's just often literally unbelievable. But he did testify. He fully documented his concerns. It's a very, very important case. Hmm.
Just to ask something else, and I'm afraid this might be complicated, but in a situation where, if you have a situation where, say, someone who either works for a private company or somebody who works for the government is required as a part of the terms of their employment to sign some kind of agreement that says, I will not divulge information that the company thinks is confidential, is proprietary, or in the case of the government, that the government has ruled as secret. What happens if in the course of the person feels that in the course of doing this whistleblowing, they must in fact divulge information that the company or the government would not like to have divulged? If they have signed some piece of paper that says, well, I won't do this, how does that complicate things?
Oh, it's one of the things I must say that the lawyers that I work with have developed a unique expertise in dealing with that environment. These confidentiality agreements are commonplace, and then it's, if you're with the government, security classifications are commonplace, and the abuse of those classifications is commonplace. You know, why not use that to stop the flow of information. We do navigate that all the time. We've confronted numerous agencies, and I'm a believer in the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. That's often all we have, and we go forward. We're very aggressive on that, by the way. You know, and our view of these restrictions are, you know, we don't want to get our client in trouble, but we're going to fight them very, very hard, and we've gone to court on it. We fought it. And I'll tell you, the first case that I did that became a major national sensation was back in 1988 when Halliburton, Brown & Root, same group out there in Iraq today who's done a lot of contracting abuses, forced an employee at an atomic energy plant to sign an agreement that they would not divulge safety problems to the government. And that was in the contract. And if they did, they would have to pay all this money. So this guy came to us. He was an electrician. He came to us and said, what can I do? I signed this agreement, but there's these safety problems. And I will say, I don't know if I'd do it today, but the way we did it was we photocopied that agreement and issued a national press release with it attached, and we went and filed legal challenges and declared it an illegal, void, disgraceful contract. Halliburton, Brown & Root pulled their political connections, tried to clobber this guy. We got a hearing in front of the House, the United States Senate Environment Public Works Committee, and they slammed Brown & Root. And these contracts were all declared illegal. And not only did they, was my client's contract declared illegal, but the companies had to divulge every other employee who signed them and tell those employees that they were unenforceable. The reason we were aggressive back then, we looked at it, is in our view of the law, you can't use the law to cover up health and safety information that's going to impact on the public health and safety. You cannot. Now, we would never take an action or advise it unless, one, the client knows every risk, and second, we think we can win. But you never know when you start. And that's why I take my hand off to these whistleblowers. This guy, an electrician with a family to support, was willing, knowing all the risks, to step forward and put everything on the line for the public interest. I mean, this guy is a hero. And he, and you know, it's not like we have an agenda in which we say we want to just run forward with this. Absolutely not. You've got to protect the whistleblower. He knew the risks. He took them. Thank God he won. Because if he lost and he was threatened with this, he would have lost his home. He never would have worked again because they would have had judgments on this guy. But he won, and he changed the law for the better. And that, and you know, and I've been representing whistleblowers for over 20 years, but that's why I love doing it, because these people are extraordinary. I mean, so many of them are really willing to risk it to help the public. And it's just, you know, it just makes doing my job, you know, really rewarding.
Yeah. We have another caller here in Urbana, so let's bring them into the conversation. Line number two. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Cohen. According to the newsletter Peer Review, the Office of Special Counsel is occupied by a man named Scott Block. Now, the newsletter doesn't think he's doing a very good job. Have you ever heard of him? Or his particular job in the Justice Department?
Yes. The Office of Special Counsel was set up to protect whistleblowers. And ever since it was established, it's really been an enemy of the whistleblower. Why? It's a political appointee position. What president wants to appoint a special counsel that's going to aggressively defend whistleblowers? And I'm telling you, it doesn't matter if it's a Democrat or a Republican, because if you're in that office, the office of the White House, do you want the whistleblowers protected? I'm hoping and praying that things will change. Mr. Block has been opposed by the entire whistleblower community for his conduct in office. We, the National Whistleblower Center, do not take an official position on political appointees in general because we are nonpartisan. We're just going to fight the issue. Doesn't matter if it's Democrat or Republican. So I'm not going to put a blame on him personally, but I will say the Office of Special Counsel itself has been an absolute failure, and it's been one of the biggest disappointments for federal employees, because if you read about what that office is supposed to do, and they do the opposite, and it's completely destructive. In fact, I was once before a judge in one of these cases, and the judge actually came straight up and said, this is, a politically appointed judge. Don't think this is a real judge in federal court.
Oh.
And it's an administrative judge who gets appointed and doesn't even have to be a lawyer. And this person said, I don't care if the whistleblower saved the taxpayers $5 billion.
Oh, swell.
I sat back and I said, what? I said, that doesn't matter. There's nothing I could do. I'm just the lawyer. You know, I can't change the law. But that's where they're at. They don't care. And I'm hoping. Now, we did a survey of every presidential candidate as to what they will do with the special counsel when they win. I will say, truth, and we're totally nonpartisan, but both Clinton and Obama said and committed to appointing a special counsel who was pro-whistleblower. Senator McCain has not responded to the survey.
No surprise there.
Well, I won't comment on that because we don't take political positions. But I think, you know, as people become more aware, and I'm glad the caller understood this, I'm glad the caller understood the significance about having that office run by cronies. They have to restore, they actually have to bring integrity to that office. It will save billions and billions in taxpayer money. Because here's what that office is supposed to do. You got to put yourself in the position of, say you're a federal employee. You don't make that much money. It's hard to hire a lawyer. You're sitting on, say, some national security estimate, and you know that maybe they're exaggerating a reason to go to war. For you to get the courage to say or do anything is extraordinary. You know, it's very rare someone will even do it, but a lot of people may think about it and know it. If there was an office that you could go to that really you knew would protect you, then that fear would be slightly diminished. If you contacted a lawyer, you say you went to the Whistleblower Center, they may say this is a good office to go to. They'll protect you. Instead, if they come to my office and they say, what should I do? I have to tell that whistleblower. If you go to OSC, they will probably rule against you and make your life miserable. Will that encourage that national security analyst to divulge information that the taxpayers and the American people absolutely need to know? You know, it's a terrible situation we find ourselves in. There's a law that has passed the House of Representatives, H.R. 981, and it's the Whistleblower Enhancement Act. It has not passed the Senate, but it would strengthen the protections for federal employees. Absolutely critical law, and I just pray it gets through this year. It may not.
One of the things that and we're unfortunately here, we have about 5 minutes left, but one of the things that I wanted to have you talk at least a little bit about is how complicated whistleblower protection law is, in the sense that different states have laws and they're different, and there are laws for people in the private sector and the public sector, and there are different laws depending on what your occupation is, and there's one that's just for the people in the military. And then if you look at the amount of time, you know, when the clock starts running for people to file complaints. It's different depending on who you are and what your job is. No surprise that you have an entire book that you've put together to try to bring all this together. Is there some chance that there could be a kind of rationalizing of this law so that it's a bit more uniform and a little bit easier to work with?
Yeah, and David, I really have to take my hat off to you. You hit the nail on the head, straight down what the general problem is with whistleblower protections. There is no one federal law that protects whistleblowers. The laws that exist are essentially scandal-driven. You know, two airplanes crashed, and they gave protection to airline pilots. The stock market crashes, so they gave it to people in publicly traded companies, but only for stock fraud. So it's hit and miss on federal. There's like 50 different federal laws, and you're, again, correct. Some of them have a 30-day statute of limitations. Some have a 2-year statute of limitations. We have urged at the Whistleblower Center, and again, our website, and thank you for mentioning, is whistleblowers.org. We have all the information on that. We've been urging the passage of one national whistleblower protection act modeled on the laws that cover civil rights, you know, that prohibit discrimination against race, age, sex, religion. We think whistleblowing should be included in that and have a similar minimum national protection. If you want stronger laws in specific industries, great. But there should be one uniform law protecting whistleblowers in the United States. It doesn't exist. It's absolutely needed. And on our website, we have information. We did question the presidential candidates on that. And again, Obama and Clinton both said they would support such an initiative. Unfortunately, Senator McCain has not responded. But that is ultimately what is needed. Until that happens, many, many valid whistleblowers will lose their cases, lose their homes, and it will be a heartbreak.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there must be many cases that don't – occasionally one of these cases will get a lot of national attention. And I certainly think about guys like and it just happened – the names come to mind because I happen to have met them and talked with them. Ernie Fitzgerald, who became well-known long time ago as a Pentagon whistleblower, and then Jeff Wigand, who worked for the tobacco industry and became maybe one of the most famous private sector whistleblowers. But I'm sure that there are a lot – that this goes on. There are many more cases that maybe get some local media attention, but don't rise to that level so that it becomes a national story.
Yeah. The vast majority of whistleblowers are don't rise to national media attention. They're just honest employees doing their job. Almost every person who comes to us looking for help, the origin of the conflict was not, I'm going to be a whistleblower. It was, I was just doing my job. And that's one of the tragedies of it, because most people, they go to work, they work honestly, but if they happen to see something at work that's wrong and they turn it in, thinking they're just doing their job to help the company, but the company doesn't want that to come out, all of a sudden they're labeled a whistleblower. Most of the people who come to the National Whistleblower Center don't even think. They say, I'm not a whistleblower. I'm just doing my job. Well, I say, I have to give them the bad news. You're a whistleblower now. I happen to think it might be good news, but no one else does.
You think that there is, in the minds of a lot of people, there is stigma attached to being labeled a whistleblower?
Yeah, well, there's stigma attached to it because I think everybody knows the impact it has on getting a job. You know, so it's something that one day I truly believe that employees that report misconduct, safety violations, fraud will be looked at culturally on the job as doing the right thing. That would be considered a positive attribute because ultimately they're going to help the company, help the society. We're not there yet. I kind of view it as where the civil rights movement was when there was still segregation. And you could think of a company, say, in the heart of Alabama, in the heart of the segregationist days, no company there is going to brag, we hired three African Americans. No, they would consistently fire them or refuse to hire them. That was not a bragging right. Times have changed. We are hoping, culturally, that times change and the stigma on whistleblowing is lifted and changes. Many people come to say, would you please change the name of your organization? We don't like that word. I'm saying no. We want the culture to change. We want someday that people recognize what these people are doing is really helping everybody.
All right. Well, if you're interested in finding out more about the National Whistleblower Center in Washington, D.C., you can go to their website, which is www.whistleblowers.org. You can find out more about the issue and about the organization. Our guest, Stephen Cohn, is the executive director of the center. He's one of the nation's leading experts on whistleblower protection law. And, Mr. Cohn, thank you very much.
David, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.